shit. Don't you say that the ghetto we are crying here. We have to get up, stand up, turn back on the school trend. The most side everlasting.
And this is how I
and this is how I am going to chase them. And this is how I am going to trying to escape this Utah. Who child is time to juggle it too wild? That's why we got more than two stars. To adapt in the situation, too sharp. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. And down to the left child, we will survive in this time to wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Juggling specialist, critical and survivalist. Spitting heaven's fire from his lips. Burning slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all that getting, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the home page, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com. That's in the Black Belt. /timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media is there also, full of new podcasts of the latest programs on Time for Awakening and always interesting articles that you can download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites and put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, the two special guests is joining us this evening, Texas historian and activist Mr. Reginald Moore, and joining Mr. Reginald Moore is Mr. Sam Collins III, talking about their work down in Texas. I don't know whether people have caught the reports of 95 bodies of our ancestors that were in forced labor down in Texas. Bodies were discovered in a mass grave. We'll talk to Mr. Moore and Mr. Collins about their work to bring this to light and also work on other fronts down there in the Texas panhandle in that Texas region where the struggle continues. But we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, brother. Yeah. How's things going?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Doing fine. Looking forward to our discussion with Mr. Moore and Mr. Collins. I think it's, especially, this weekend, we celebrated another year or identified another year with Mr. Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the African Community League, which was his birthday on the 17th. So just in seeing these two men do the, what I guess I call the excavation of our history and trying to assist in the preservation of our narrative and our story, it'll be fantastic to be able to share and learn from their particular experience.
You know, I ran across this article, and then I've seen it in several other periodicals dealing with this story. I knew it was something that we needed to bring to Time for an Awakening to let our people know exactly what was going on down in Texas. That narrative that's always thrown around about slavery ended in 1865 or 63 by Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was never true. This is more evidence of it. The 95 bodies of our ancestors that were discovered at a construction site, convict leasing, forced labor, which was nothing but slavery. And we'll talk to our guests this evening about their work dealing with this issue and others. Brother Moore is with us. Brother Reginald Moore and Mr. Sam Collins is joining us this evening in conversation. Let's get them right up. Mr. Moore, how are you, sir?
Good morning. Good evening, rather. How are you guys doing? Thank you for the privilege to be on the Black Talk Radio, radio station, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to join you guys in this provocative conversation and allowing us to enlighten the people, encourage and hopefully empower them to this tragedy that that happened down here in Texas.
And also, Mr. Sam Collins III is joining us. Mr. Collins?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on with Mr. Moore. I'm looking forward to talking with you all and bringing light to this situation also.
I'm glad to have both of you men on here. First, I want to ask Mr. Moore, because he was instrumental in this, and from published reports, his name was out front because he was the one that brought this this tragedy to light after three decades of research on this topic of a convict leasing and forced labor to uncover this mass grave of 95 to 100 bodies of our ancestors of all various ages. Before you get into that particular site, Mr. Moore, talk about what made you travel down this path to even start this work.
Well, I was correctional officer at the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, which is now used to be called Texas Department of Corrections, on the particular area site, which is encompasses about 5,000 acres. So right there at the site where I was at, I worked at the first prison that came into existence in the state of Texas called the Jester Unit. And I worked at the Jester 1 Unit and Jester 3 for about 4 years, 85, 86, 87, and 88. And I saw, during that period of time, I saw the sentences disparity came in 85, when they had about 30-some prisons in prisons at the time, and now they have over 100. And so I was going to write a book on then and now, cause and effects, about the sentence and disparity that I saw when I was working there as an officer. I related to one particular instance when they had the crack cocaine disparity, where, you know, the blacks were coming in and doing more time, what it should have been basically held as being ill. And they were given these long sentences there between, while the whites had to do actual hard criminal acts and were given less sentences between that and the disparity. So I started researching that, and I was going to tell my story about that, of the history of that sentence of disparity and how the prison industrial complex has blossomed, became a business exploiting our people. And there was an old house there. It was called the Warden's House. That was right on the site which is a few miles up from just the one unit. And I wanted to get that, put that book, that house, the history of that house, and I was going to use that house as a cover of my book. So when I went to research that house, come to find out that was the old warden's house, which I thought maybe it was during the slavery period of time prior to 1865, because it would have that old plantation, old colonial style to it. When I found out that was the warden's house, which I realized that from working there, that house was in usage up until during a period of time when I was working in the 80s. But to find out that was the house that Leadbelly, Huey Leadbelly, swung his way out of prison and to get his freedom. And when I found out that information, I also found out that during that time, they was getting ready to sell all this acreage of land that was there. And this was around 2001. And they ended up selling in 2003. So in 2001, when I found out the history about the Compact lease and the atrocities that happened there, and I started, I went to my historian activism mode instead of just being writing a book. I started going into history preservation, trying to get these acknowledgments for this atrocity that happened, and the fact that they hadn't been recognized, and the fact that we didn't have any graves that had been found during a period of slavery, antebellum period, or during a period when this conflict leasing was happening. And I stressed to them that there should be archaeological studies, there should be some preservation efforts done to see exactly what happened and where these people were buried at that time. So that's when my activism started, as far as trying to make sure that these people were recognized and some type of restitution, some type of reparation, reconciliation, and hopefully they'll come through repentance and revival to see that these guys should have sweat equity. And since they were victimized, and free men who were reinstitutionalized, what I call slavery by a new name, okay, then I feel like they had to be rewarded, and their descendants had to be rewarded for the atrocity by them being reinstitutionalized. So that's where my efforts started there, in trying to get the state of Texas, trying to get the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, Texas Historical Commission, the city of Sugar Land, all of them, before the land got sold in after the fact, when it sold, so that these guys could have some type of, acknowledgement and some type of recognition to their ancestors for them being exploited, and had this trickle-down effect that we're having and seeing today that's holding our people in prison and keeping them in bondage.
Mr. Moore, according to the published reports, the archaeologist that's on site said that the bodies that were discovered of our ancestors range in age from 14 to 70, and they all showed signs of high stress, where they had been physically worked, beaten, things of that nature. The identification, were you able to, because I know in your research, you found this site and others, I think, that you've been working on. Were you able to trace down the identity of any of these men, even though it happened quite a while ago?
That's what we're working on now. And I'm working with the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. I'm talking to the executive director, Mr. Collier, who's the head person over the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. I'm working with other historians, and people who were able to, go back and genealogy individuals and trying to find particular records. We've actually kind of came up with a few records that may have 16 names that are going out to about four names in them right now. And we're working on that as we speak. And I've gotten that information, and we should be sorting that out where it's possible. They may have a few names available here. And from that point, we're going to see if we can't trace them back into do a DNA type of study and analysis, which I met with I had a meeting this week, this Friday, with the Historical Commission for Bend Independent School District, which this is found in the city of Sugar Land, and the Texas Historical Commission, trying to get some DNA studies done that's going to happen where they're going to pull teeth and they're going to, you know, they're going to get the dollars or whatever to start doing this DNA process. So right at this moment, we haven't really clearly pinpointed any of those names in there, but we're working and we're getting close. And the prison records don't have anything, but we deep researching very heavily along with the archaeologist there named Rain Clark. And I believe that he's trying to work, you know, extremely hard to expose this and trying to get that research. So we're doing an oral report now and trying to, you know, get names and tying all that back. But it's been a heck of an effort to do this because at that period of time, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice had leased out all those guys, the whole prison system, to a guy named Cunningham and Ellis. And the state themselves didn't actually, even though they sanctioned this and they only had one building in Huntsville called the Walls Unit, they didn't have other prisons. So during that company lease period, the records were not kept basically by the state of Texas, okay, until 1886 when the state took over the company lease system. And they ran it from 1886 to approximately around 1912. So it's been a very difficult, but we're getting close to where we should, and within the next few weeks, hopefully, with all these efforts from different perspectives of individuals in academia, we'll be close to hopefully finding some of those names, and then from there we can just start doing some DNA testing.
You know, according to one of the published reports, it says it's up to 15,000. In several sites around the state of Texas, it could be over 15,000 bodies of our ancestors buried in mass graves in several different sites. But before you speak to that issue, because you mentioned something about a law firm that was dealing with this before the state took over, I just want to read something from one of the published reports that reference some of your comments, Mr. Moore. And this is for our listening audience. Although the listening audience of Time for Awakening kind of knows a lot about this period, but I just want to read this for some of the listening audience that may not know, to understand the gravity of what went on during that period and how the government, the very government of the United States, was totally involved in this, even though the charade of slavery ending was the narrative was put forth. Let me read a couple of these paragraphs. It says, hold on one second here. Let me find exactly where I am here. It says, researchers believe that the recently discovered dead were among thousands of African-American prisoners who were forced to work on plantations, railways, and mines in the wake of the Civil War. The 13th Amendment, ratified in 1865, outlawed slavery, but exceptions were explicitly made for prisoners. In response, Southern state legislatures quickly passed black codes, new laws that explicitly applied only to black people and subject them to criminal prosecution for offenses such as loitering, breaking curfew, vagrancy, having weapons, and not carrying proof of employment. According to the nonprofit Equal Justice Initiative, which focuses in its work on racial and economic injustice, these laws were crafted to ensnare black people and return them to chains. These laws were effective. For the first time in U.S. history, many state penal systems held more black prisoners than white, all of whom were part of convict leasing for profit.
That is correct, and you pretty much on point. There's been a lot of stories, and I've helped, from many different sources, from, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, and we've been on, CBS this morning, and trying to, you know, make sure that the word get out. As you're well aware, they have a guy named Douglas Blackman put out a documentary called Slavery by Another Name.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it Slavery by a New Name. Well, the documentary started in the 1890s, and I think it was, I know it was Louisiana, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, where they talk about the convict leasing. But the tragedy is that they left Texas out of this, and Texas were the first ones to implement the convict leasing system. When the 13th Amendment was put into existence 6 months after Texas got their word that they were free in Juneteenth, we call it now here, June 19th, 1865. In December of 1865, the 13th Amendment was passed that said you were free unless convicted of a crime. You can go back into servitude. So 6 months later, the federal government implemented it. And then 1866, the state of Texas legislated into law here. And then in 1867, they started leasing out, and they tried it first in Galveston in 1867, but they did not, the persons that ran it did not have, called Warren Dewey, did not have land themselves, and they tried, did not work. But the successful one started in 1878, which was old, you know, old plantation owners. Old plantation became prison, old plantation owners became wardens. So what you have here is that the state legislated this in, and they approved of this, and so that was a tragedy amongst itself. But prior to that, you know, we had in 1824 here, all of the Austin 300s that came here, they were all slave owners. And each one of them, they bought slaves from the Carolinas, the Tennessees, to work this land in agreement with Mexico, which said you could use this particular area of land here, but you're not supposed to bring slaves in. They brought slaves in anyhow, and then they said that whoever, whatever slave you bring, after they didn't agree with them, they say they have to, have to be born free, and the ones you bring have to be free after 5 years. Stephen F. Austin gave an incentive for every slave you bring down here, you get an extra 80 acres of land. And I believe that that's, you know, his, they had a situation just started here lately, but he was trying to change Austin, the state capital of Austin, and to change the name on it. The blacks, they built the state capital, you know, for they quarried the stones for that in the convict leasing. The county that we in here is Fort Bend County, the county courthouse is all built by this, the railroads, everybody benefited, because after slavery was over with, the state of Texas was in a destitute situation, okay? They had lost the war, the plantation had decimated, then they lost this free labor, okay? And for in order for them to get that, the federal government appeased the Southerners down here by creating the Article 13. And so that's when they had that the slaves had, Stephen F. Austin them had brought down here. They were free, and then they were reinstitutionalized after a short period of time during Reconstruction, when blacks were free at that time. They had rights, they had voting rights, they outnumbered the whites, the plantation owner. Plantation owner may have had 10 people in his family, he may have had 50 to 100 or maybe even 200 slaves. So after that, they were able to vote themselves in. So they had a hard time getting that labor back because blacks were free. So this is when they legislated it in and they implemented it, and that's when you started coming up with this point that you said that if you were vagrant or you got caught. Another thing they had called a pig law was similar to, I thought was called, it was like the crack law. If you got stuck caught stealing a pig, it could have been a wild pig. They gave you 15 years time. And so they exploited those people, our people, and they worked them severely. And they called various, because they worked them so bad, and it was such an atrocity, and it was crimes against humanity. Okay, this was crime against humanity. As you well aware, when now, if you, it's called the Humane Society, if you mistreat an animal bad, the Humane Society will come in and by law will, you know, put charges against you for treating the animal wrong. These people were treated worse than animals, and there was not a Humane Society. And it was allocated, justified, and through all the individuals, the state of Texas who legislated, and the individuals who condoned it and exploited them through this system. So these guys were very much taken advantage of. They were exploited. They were worked severely. They were malnourished. They didn't have the proper medical treatment, and they worked them so bad they said that their muscles were tearing off their bones because of the work was so labor-induced, and they were treated them so bad they actually were treated sometimes worse than this. They were in slavery because sometimes the slave owner felt that he had investment in these slaves as far as investment. But during this period of time, they were treated and leased out to other camps, and they were just it was just a horrendous act, and that they were victimized, and that's why we see now that these guys, you know, they're doing the remains there, that they're saying that that the muscles and everything was torn off, similar to what they found up in New York during that period of time when they found that all those bodies up in New York at the, I believe it was up in New York during that period of time when they found a bunch of bodies up there similar to this. But, you know, that's what we have here, man. It was just a horrendous act, and that's why there should be some type of restitution, some type of recognition for this atrocity that they call a hellhole on the Brazos. It was such a terrible place to be, and just crimes against humanity through the exploitation.
Brother Richard, jump in.
Yes, Brother Moore. What I wanted you to, help us, flush out. Well, now, again, this was in the city of Sugar Land, or what is now in the city, these around this where this plantation was?
Yes, sir. It's actually prior to 1959. It was in the county of Fort Bend County. And this area here was called a company town, which the Kempner family owned, and some other ones and the other individuals owned, and the guys Cunningham and Ellis owned before they sold it to the Kempner family and Sugar Land Industries around 1908. In 1959, the city of Sugar Land incorporated this Imperial Sugar, which was a company town, that's where basically a lot of the company leasing system was and were exploited at. In this county that became a city in the county called Sugar Land in 1959. Prior to that, it was all under the auspices of Fort Bend County with a company called Sugar Land, which is a company town, but did not actually have what be called a city at that time.
And I wanted to go back to your personal journey on this. And you did speak to, how you got into this and the effect. What did it change in relationship to having this particular history? And I take it you're from the area. What did it change in you in seeing this here type of process? I guess the question is, did you know about the convict leasing before and after? How did you get to see where you are now as far as the communities that you live in?
Well, I'm a native Houstonian. Most of my parents are from Texas. When I went to work in 1985, the first unit I went to was just one, was the first prison after the company lease system, after the state did not renew Cunningham and Ellis contract that ran from 1873 to 1878. The state took it over in 1886, and the first prison, which is so significant about this site, a lot of history that's been happening here, was a plantation, convict leasing, all this happened on one site, and the first prison that was established was called the Harlem Prison, which is the Harlem Plantation. Then it went from the Harlem name, Harlem Plant, Harlem Unit, to the Justin Unit. When I went there, it seems like I was taking a step back in time. It looked to the, as it does today in its existence, and it looked like it was an old plantation. When I went there, we had no black majors or captains in the whole Texas Department of Criminal Justice system. They were forced in 1982 to hire blacks through a Carla Ruiz Estelle case. So there were very few black officers there. So when I went there, all the white officers on horseback, when the guys would turn out in the field, were all white, and they were working them, extremely hard, terrible conditions even back then. So that kind of made me feel like, hey, something's not right here, with this system here. And I felt appalled by it. I felt like it was some injustice that's going on back in the past and now. And again, when I left the system, when I wanted to go back and do a little history and talk about, you know, what I saw, what I experienced, okay, during that period of time, that's when it took me to the history aspect of it. And also, you know, when I found out, I started doing the work, I found out about the Innocence Project. Well, if someone here in Texas, and I believe even around the nation, if they have been found innocent of a crime and they were wrongly convicted and done time for that, they get some type of restitution through the Innocence Project. And I feel like these guys, after I found out this study that I started doing in 1999 and actually went to every agency that the state that was part of the state to try to get these guys recognized and some type of restitution, recognition for this. And I was saying, if you can't give them restitution, can't find a DNA for reparation, let us build a memorial and a museum. And that's what I'm basically trying to do, get a memorial and a museum built down here to acknowledge this tragedy, this atrocity that happened here on this Fort Bend County area, which is now part of the city of Sugar Land. And Fort Bend Independent School District actually bought this land from a newly development, and I believe part of maybe what the city has owned in a collaboration with them, and the state, you know, sanctioned this, and they sold it from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And I believe Fort Bend County more or less inherited, and I believe they're trying to do the best they can because they have a superintendent there, the school district, who's an African-American from Morocco, and he's honored that the fact that this happened on his watch, but I had to enforce them and make them come into compliance with the preservation laws before they came on board to start trying to advocate and try to do the right thing. Whereas they are, right now, they want to, we're getting those bodies taken out of that area with a night where they're at now. In eyesight, I'm over the a cemetery called the Old Imperial Central Cemetery, and I've been the guardian of that cemetery for about 12 years, okay? And that cemetery came about in 1912, right at the same time the public lease system was over with. And so I took that cemetery up, and the state gave me an authority to be the guardian of it, and that's where I'm at now. And hopefully I'll continue to be the guardian when we try to take those bodies out from the Fort Bend Independent School site and intern them after that they get through the studies and the bioanthropology work on it, okay? Then we're planning to intern them in the Old Imperial Central Prison Cemetery, and we plan to have a memorial site built there. But I'm not quite sure my position with the city of Sugar Land, whether or not I'll still be the guardian, but we've been protesting, we've been initiating with the office of them coming into that cemetery, put those bodies there instead of taking them to another place of interment other than the site. And to my first opinion, I thought the bodies should have stayed there at the site. But they had a new ruling came out in 2017 here that said that the bodies can't be exhumed here. And that was a law that the developers got in place so that now they can desecrate bodies, especially black bodies. Mm. Because there's a white cemetery, I believe that they would not be talking about moving those bodies. Okay, but because it was our people, they were victimized then, they're victimized now. They fought with me to get into that cemetery, which is Old Imperial Cemetery, to get acknowledgments for that. I had to fight for them, for the Fort Bend County to recognize these to do archaeological studies. And it's been a fight. But now we're getting this recognition with the help of you guys and others, so that these people can be recognized and we can bear them right, recognize them right, memorialize them right, and have a museum that can represent the whole United States and the state of Texas. Because basically, there's a high probability that there are other camps that's on this 2,000-acre tract that they sold in 2003, according to the anthropologists in my work, that the bodies are under some of these buildings and some of these homes that are here because they did not do archaeological research work that was required to do in 2003. They circumvented that because they felt like if they'd have found any bodies there during that time, they would have had to stop the studies because the law said at that time if you found a body or several bodies, you had to make that area a cemetery until the law changed. So they circumvented all the preservation laws, and so now people are upset and wondering if their homes up under bodies, these buildings at their University of Houston in the Sugar Land, it was a site there now. There are possible bodies there in several other little church locations in that same proximity of areas that there are probably other camps, and where each one of those camps were, there was bodies. This was called the Ellis Camp, which comes from the guy Cunningham and Ellis, who were old Confederate soldiers who came out of Confederacy, who started that company Gleason. And they got names, street names, out for these people. Okay, Cunningham and Ellis. They even had one of the prisons that was named Ellis Prison. And you also, they have Plantation Grove, communities named Plantation Grove, Siena Plantation. It glamorized this tragedy and as being something that they are proud of instead of them being remorseful of. And that's what we're trying to get to the situation is, where do we go from here? Hopefully there'll be some healing and some type of recognition, and then we can get the proper thing, and we can stay in position as the advocates of this, and we don't be put that back in a back burner so that we can have this done correctly.
You know, the question I'm asking, well, how big is the population, the black population in that area of the prison or in the city, I guess, of Sugar Land itself?
Sam, could you go in and speak on that? I really don't have a statistic. Sam is from the National Trust. He has a lot of information. Can you speak on some of this, Sam?
Yeah, I don't have the exact numbers, but that area south of Houston in Sugar Land, Missouri City, is considered one of the more diverse areas, where you basically have four major groups that pretty much 25%. 25% black, 25% white, 25% Hispanic, and then even, I want to say, like international Asian population, because the what Mr. Moore is talking about, the explosion of development in that area, being a suburb of Houston, a lot of homes and communities that were built up, they never did the studies. So he's correct. If there were 15,000 bodies buried all over this area, not just right there in Fort Bend County, but in the Fort Bend County, Brazoria County, these other areas, they're bound to be on top of some of these grave sites because they didn't do the studies and didn't stop construction, even if they did hit some bodies.
And, the reason why I'm asking is because it seems that this, you know, especially when we're talking about preservation, because we had the same challenge around preservation here. You know, we just found a cemetery in the city of Philadelphia, and the whole kind of thrust of trying to get, which used to be a church cemetery. Matter of fact, the AME church cemetery. And then, you know, and finding that, which is now a part of a recreation area, and going through the discussion with the city about, you know, creating it as an education or giving it an appropriate memorial. And the question that we're dealing with is what we consider appropriate. And that's why I'm kind of interested in, either from, you know, Brother Moore and Brother Collins, just the interest. How much of the black population, because it is a political question, because the government actually created this situation, how much of this historical understanding around convict leasing, around the abuse within the prison industrial, because this is now the same kind of discussion going on around prisons and utilizing prisoners. For as a part of the economic development for private companies. So I'm asking how much are the community aware of the history of the area and this particular situation specifically, as far as the black community.
Mr. Moore, you mind if I answer, or you want?
Go ahead, Sam. Let them know that you would. National Trust, he has a lot of work on this. He's also been advisor of the Historical Commission. He's very in-depth on that. Go ahead, Sam.
Well, I'm sure what he's speaking about. I've served as on the Board of Advisors with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. So your point about this nationwide concern with regards to our history and historical sites, individuals are facing the same challenges all over the country. And I would say around the world, of just preserving our history and culture. But one of the things with our community is, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but there's an ignorance around the subject matter.
Yes.
And they just don't know. And myself included, when Mr. Moore brought me in April, asked me to attend an event, he has educated me to a lot of things that I didn't know. And I've been involved in the preservation community on the national, state, local level, in the county, and some of the details of this information I didn't know. So myself, I was ignorant, but now I'm reading, researching, trying to become more knowledgeable about these things. And you know, some historians may say, well, it was obvious, all this stuff was out there. But I'm talking about drilling down. And just recently, last week, I actually went to a library here in Galveston and found an actual contract for convict labor. They actually had a copy of an actual contract in the Texas History Center right here in Galveston, and it's been in their collection for years. And the reason that this is important, when you go and read the actual contract, one of the stipulations, number two of the contract, is that the convicts whose labor is to be furnished under this contract shall be Negroes. So it's important for people to understand that that was a stipulation of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say, you know, and we celebrate Juneteenth here, I'm a big proponent of you know, remembering the holiday and things, but I also understand that it just didn't. They just changed the rules and re-enslaved individuals. But I think it was an important part in that timeline that there was a certain progress being made, but then immediately we need to understand how that progress was snatched away, or that freedom was snatched away with these laws and these contracts and re-enslaving individuals, not only through the convict leasing, but the even before Austin came. You know, one of the things with Mexico, they said you have to free your slaves. So they would free their slaves with an agreement that the slaves had to sign for a lifetime of servitude as a laborer. So they changed the title from slave to laborer, but it was in effect the same thing, because they were signing away their rights and their children not yet even born rights. How can you do that for generations? This is something they put in place in the 1820s and 1830s, because Mexico said you can't have slavery. So what they did, they would free the slaves and then make them sign a contract to work on the farms that they were coming to in Texas to pay off debts for housing, food, clothes. And that's a debt that they never could get out of, the same as sharecropping and other things that later came on. So the rules just continue to change to keep the same system in place.
To gentlemen and Elliot, you know, to think again, and when we're dealing with another thing that we were dealing with here, we have a cemetery, Eden Cemetery, that goes back to 1910, thereabouts. And one of the things that we are noticing in relationship to not just preservation, but with the historical society, is the point of, we don't have enough records as the African American community about this story from our perspective, and that the cemeteries become a record in and of itself. And the work that I hear that you're trying to that you're putting together, Mr. Moore, as far as getting the DNA study and whatever, is really helping in developing a record that we didn't have before. So my question, Mr. Collins, to you is, part of the preservation, do you see us having a lack, and I say us, I mean African-Americans and the institutions that we have, having enough historical documents of our own, and you just mentioned that contract, to be able to deal with these kind of issues? Do you see that as a challenge?
Well, one of the challenges that I found just personally, even working in the preservation community, is sometimes even knowing the right questions to ask, because just like this contract, there are often documents and information we could access. The only reason I was able to get that contract, I was working trying to find some more information in the library, and a young man in the Texas History Center working there heard me talking to someone else about convict leasing. And he approached me and said, we have a copy of a contract in our collection. Now, if he been working there and alerted me to the fact that they had a copy, I wouldn't have even known that they had that in their collection. Now, maybe I would have stumbled across it later, but it shortened up the time frame. So part of the thing, some of these records and things are there. We just have to start digging more and looking for them. We may not have them in our personal collection and possession, but we need to start digging more. And some things we do have in our communities. Our ancestors have things in their homes, or our elders have things in their collection, in their Bibles, in their notes, in their drawers that we don't pay attention to. When someone passes away, we try to sell the furniture, sell some things, but we're not paying attention. They may have documents in a box in a closet, and we just sit it on the side of the road. And so much information has been lost because of that, because we didn't know what we were looking at. We didn't know the value of the items in our collection and what we had. And we need to be more conscious of what's around us and recognize that even the oral histories of our elders needs to be recorded. Individuals need to sit down, speak to their elders. If they have grandparents in their 80s, 90s, even people that are still 100, and my great-grandmother lived to 104 in 10 months. We interviewed her all the way up to 103. To capture that information that she had is priceless. I mean, it's priceless to us now, that family history. She ate with her grandparents that were enslaved individuals, and she ate with my youngest son that was born in 2009 with an African-American president. So, I mean, her span of connection between her grandparents were born in the 1849, 1850, all the way up to her great-great-grandson being born in 2009, that connection, she was the link between that past and you know, 2012 she passed away. But we just need to be more conscious and search more for this information and share it when we receive it and talk about it.
Elliot, if I can ask one more question to Mr. Moore. Me and Elliot was talking about this, and the thing that came across my mind is the continuity. When we talk about convict leasing at the turn of the century in Texas, and now we're talking about the whole thing of the prison industrial complex. You who are, you know, actually been working and then moved into the actual the historical and pushing for, and I'm glad you are pushing for reparations. How does coming out of the 80s, how does this topic affect you, or how do you see this now that you have a longer historical view that this is not no new thing when we talk about the prison industrial complex?
Well, when I first got that, when I started, man, it's been a life-changing event for me. It took a lot of toll on me from the struggles, from the fights, and the pressure that I've been in as far as being oppressed, trying to bring this knowledge to the forefront. Mm. And I felt victimized, similar to the way they victimized our people in slavery, and also victimized them when slavery was over during the Reconstruction period by reinstitutionalizing. And the same way I sort of felt when I worked in the prisons, they really didn't have a whole lot of respect for the black officers. Some of the white inmates were treated better than some of the black officers because we forced them to allow us in there. They did not want us in there to be a voice and be advocates for the atrocities that were being consumed in the Department of Corrections, with actually up until recently. And then still to some point today, as you go, they still are using and exploiting this labor in a way that they're doing now in a lot of institutions. You can pull up some things with Alex and what they're doing as far as how a lot of these states are benefiting from this convict labor and actually putting labor forces out, a lot of the labor unions out. And so I felt appalled, man, and I felt like it was a God-given duty to me that I picked up as an administrator. I was taking up a course and from a college biblical studies and seminary that was teaching me about community economic development. And I started learning and started picking up Luke 4:18. The Spirit of the Lord had anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, heal the brokenhearted, restore sight to the blind, and set the captives free. I felt like those people were in bondage. We are still in bondage today. And I felt like it was a God-given call and an anointing to make sure that this message get out, this truth get out, and the history be told and rewritten to acknowledge them that since it hadn't been rewritten. I went to the State Board of Education, trying to put it in the history books, rewrite it. We had some of our individuals who were also black in positions, as some of these positions that I went to did not quite want to gravitate and hold this and be a part of the change.
Sometimes
we are still part of the problem, not sort of the solution. So it has been a great awakening, and it was heartfelt to me. And also, I believe it had a little part of my health, that I had a health scare last year because of the fact that I believe that I put a lot of work into this and that it took a little toll on my health. And it may have been some other issues that came involved with that, but I believe it played a big part. And now that we're getting this recognition, it seemed like a burden has been lifted because they were all telling me I was wrong. Nothing was there. And they fought me from all different kind of angles. From the state all the way down to the local individuals. And letters I wrote to the governor, to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice Board, to the Texas Historical Commission, trying to get them recognized at the Capitol, all those individual fights and collective fights that I've also had some support from different times. But it basically has been my primary effort of fighting this. And, you know, and it just, it's been gratifying at the same time, but it's still a hurtful thing, even though we've gotten this recognition to the fact that when I went to see these bones in the grave site, which I was privileged to do this, now Mr. Collins was there also, it kind of took me back and it was almost, you know, almost had me the way I almost blacked out, you know. Actually seeing the people who have been fighting for and advocating for basically 20 years, and to see their bones there, and I actually didn't see skeleton bones, I seen the flesh, and because I knew the history of what was going on with these guys and what had happened, and there was a book all called P-Knowledge of Prophet, and the, you know, you read all these stories, and you dictate all this information, it becomes personal to you, and I felt like I have a relationship as a representative and as an ancestor to these people. And so it's just been, you know, like I say, rewarding, but at the same time, it's been something that's been something I've been, grieving over at the same time. Feel like you've maybe lost a loved one or something of that nature, because these are people that I feel real close to. And so I'm happy at the same time. I'm grateful. I'm humble. But at the same time, we haven't necessarily gotten the true recognition that they deserve yet that I'm hoping to get. And hopefully it'll go further than just them being reinterned. And hopefully the city and other individual groups will come in and try to take this thing in another direction beyond which we've orchestrated and initiated to make sure that they're getting their proper due, because now you have other entities coming in and want to try to direct it another direction.
Okay.
I know that feeling. That's happening here with Bethel Burial Ground.
Yes, sir. And so that's where we're going with this, and hopefully we'll be the ones to memorialize. And we're having a Labor Day event here, which I've been having for the last 5 or 6 years, on Labor Day, honoring the fact that the convict lease was all about labor. And I've been educating PhDs and professors and acknowledging them through these Labor Day events. And I usually have an Emancipator Award, to give it out to someone who showed the courage and valor in spite of this. Even the abolitionists who stood up when it wasn't popular to whites, who did the Underground Railroad here. And our Underground Railroad did not, with Harriet Tubman and them, didn't go up north to where you guys at in Philadelphia. It ran to Mexico. So Santa Ana was coming down here to free the blacks because he told them that y'all broke this contract. And so the Alamo, he was coming to free the blacks and to extract and the whites off of this land because of the atrocities they were putting out as far as doing this period during the Alamo. And so, you know, that's what he was coming. If they would have won that war in 1836, the blacks would have been freed 30 years earlier. So that's why I stand on this, man. It's still a hardening thing. It's still overwhelming. And hopefully, as time goes, it'll be a healing to the ancestors and to me as far as getting these things that we've been working on and advocating for to come into fruition, into existence, to recognize them, you know, in a grateful way. And that's why I'm grateful for Sam Collins. Got another individual, Richard Vogel, who's been with me, and his wife, Adele. Guy named Jay Jenkins with the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition, and another gentleman who's worked very tireless with me is called Mr. Ken Brown. He's head archaeologist at the University of Houston. So, you know, that's been played a part, and later than Melissa Thibodeau over the years with helping. So it's been a reward, and I've had some support, and I'm grateful for the individuals and groups like yourselves for coming on board and having the courage to be able to help bring this the past and this atrocities and these crimes against humanity to the forefront.
We're going to take a couple calls for you, Mr. Collins and Mr. Moore. Let's go to Newport News. Newport News.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
How are you,
Can
sir?
Can you hear me? Oh, just fine. Mr. Collins and Mr. Moore, I'm not going to take up a lot of your time, but I did hear you mention a university professor out of Houston, so I'm going to ask. Already had any contact with Professor Gerald Horn out of the University of Houston?
That's a good point. I think we have reached out to him. The gentleman from the University of Houston I'm working with, Dr. Ken Brown, the head anthropologist for the University of Houston, has he told me forward information and all, and I hadn't personally tried to reach out through him other than using our advisor person, which is Dr. Kenneth Brown, who's a colleague of him, and he's enlightened him about this. We've had radio shows at PBS. We've done some clips there. And all the information that's been out, I would have figured and thought that maybe he would maybe contact us along with the contact that we'd use with Dr. Kenneth Brown, his colleague at the University of Houston. And I haven't heard anything from Mr. Gerald Horn, and hadn't heard anything from the NAACP, the Urban League personally, or any of the leaders, spiritual leaders around here, the ministers, or none of that, have given me a call. So we're kind of lacking in that particular area with our local black participants, you know, who are in authority. And hopefully he can, you know, he can reach out along with some of our black universities and scholars.
Tell you if it's at all possible, if Brother Elliot could give me some contact information for you, I'd be more than happy to try to connect with several of the females that I know are doing research around the country. I'll be honest with you, I'm shocked that I don't know who you are, and this is actually the first time I've ever heard about it. But what I'm saying is over the last 5 years, I've done some work with some brothers over at New Abolitionist Radio, and Bro Elliot and Richard are familiar with them. And I try to do a little research for them all the time. So there's several professors all around the country that have written a lot of books on this. And I think if we kind of start a citizen thing, we might be able to push them to help you with that, because there are a lot of information that you're looking for is actually in some of the archives of some of these courthouses. And Gerald Horn is an expert on that. So you maybe should get a point man to push him a little bit to give you some contacts, even if he's a prolific author and he might just be tied up with deadlines and stuff. But I know he's deeply involved in this, and I do appreciate your work. I'm going to mute myself.
Thank you. And I've read several of Mr. Gerald Horn's work. And matter of fact, over the years, I went to one of his seminars before this here came about for the interest of what I'm doing. And I believe I've reached out to him indirectly before these bodies were found over the years, I believe once. We do have a lady named Ms. Andrea Roberts that's reaching out to help, and she's a PhD out of Texas A&M. And we also have a lady named Ms. Helen Graham, who's a genealogist who's on board now, who's going to tell the Black history, both of them African Americans. So, you know, I'm grateful for their particular work doing this. And it was a gentleman that helped me over the years, named Fred McGee, that's been helped over the years and with this. And we did have one group called the National Black United Front that kind of came up and did a little bit of recognition of acknowledgement, trying to help out. But we're still behind as far as community involvement, our universities and some of our esteemed professors, even though we've gotten contacts from the African American National Museum up there in Washington, D.C., and they contacted me a year or so ago, almost 2 years ago, when I had my work archived at Rice University, and you can pull it up, called Reginald Moore Sugarland Convict Lease. They had an exhibit there, and they ran that, and Mr. Dr. Gallardo, who's the curator, who's the gentleman over the slavery section for the African American Museum, the one in D.C., and they showed a lot of interest. He's supposed to have been coming down to be one of our guest speakers on Labor Day, but he could not make it because of time or another appointment. But he was so interested from a couple of years ago to now, is trying to work with us from that regard. And so I'm grateful for him reaching out to us. So, you know, hopefully we can get a lot more of these individuals on board and just come in to advocate for us, not necessarily, you know, try to steer it another direction or put that, because we put so much work in it, and hopefully they can partner with us in a point where we'll all be working together instead of, you know, people jockeying for position to try to, you know, make this their history instead of the work that we've done to expound on it so that they can go into deeper depth as far as acknowledgement.
Wow. Let's go to 267. 267? 267? Let's put 267 back on. Let's go to 602.
I'm just listening now. I'm just listening more now.
Let's go to 404. 404, are you there? Let's go to 267 again. 267.
Brother Elliot.
Yes.
Can you hear me, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Brother Elliot, it's a very good conversation. And what he's talking about is very interesting, what's synonymous to South Philadelphia, like Richard is talking about. And I know about the racism in Texas. I had a friend of mine who went from Waco, Texas, to California, and he talks about his experience. And plus, I've always wanted to go to Galveston, Texas, where Jack Johnson was from. But we have an experience here in South Philly very similar. And the graveyard at Fourth and Catherine, of course, belongs to Mother Bethel at 6th and Lombard. And that whole area is so significant. And just recently, not too long ago, Du Bois mural came up, I guess in like the last 10 years, who also lived in that area at 6th and Lombard. He lived on Rodman Street. But the significance of what I'm saying to this gentleman here is that we're in the same predicament, that I wish somebody in Philadelphia would purchase that grave site. You see, so much is going on with that whole area, from Cheney University, which was once called Institution for Colored Youth, as Nathan Bainbridge. We don't even have a plaque there. Same thing with just recently erected City of Philadelphia erected a statue of O.B. Cato. But prior to that, you got Julian Bell, who designed the art museum, and also the library who lives at 1515 Catherine Street. We don't have a plaque there. So what they're experiencing there, we're experiencing here. We all have to get together and somehow, some way, erect what is buried of ours and what is buried of our history to bring it back. But somehow, some way, we as a people, wherever we're at, if they're not going to do it for us, somehow we have to do it ourselves. So I know the brother's trying. We have the same experience here in Philadelphia that you had. And we need to talk about this because we got to get this stuff together. What is ours that nobody, we don't want anybody to take?
Yeah. You know, Tim, I heard you and Richard when you were pointing out what was going on down there at Mother Bethel. The only thing different with that is that the Bethel burial ground is our ancestors that were buried with dignity by the black church during that period. But these men that were part of convict leasing and forced labor, they were basically worked to death and disgraced, thrown into mass graves. So it's a little bit different what was done to our ancestors down there in Texas as opposed to up here, you know, with Mother Bethel. Even though they're both disrespected by the powers that be, so to speak, but what was done to our ancestors down there in Texas and Sugarland and Galveston area is a little bit different.
Well, we have a lady named from Vanderbilt University, Jane Landers. She's done a lot of work on history and African the diaspora. And we also been trying to get with Louis Gates to see if he could be willing to do some work with this. And we're working on our own personal documentary that I'm working with. The young lady name is Hannah Byers, who's a local resident here, African-American. We're partnering to try to do a documentary so that we can enrich the country and also get the federal government to give some type of acknowledgement, because that Article 13 is still on the books. So we want to be the hub that can influence and have an archival work, sort of like, because they did lynching here, sort of like what you have with the Lynching Museum with Brian Stevenson and with the Equal Justice Initiative. So we want to, this part, what we want to do is dealing with the convict leasing, the plantation, the convict leasing, and slavery, which all took place in one tract of land in the first state prison that was built. And it incubated from what we started here in 1867 and went all throughout the South. So we feel like we have an obligation to tell this whole story, and I think Sam can expound on that a little bit.
Yeah, I think we also when we are negotiating with our elected officials and people in power, we have to let them know that we have equity in this system, in the sense that we have never been paid for that equity. And one of the ways to repair and heal is to create institutions and like the museum where Mr. Moore's talking about, where individuals can be trained and educated, bring in speakers like Dr. Horn, bring in other speakers that could bring us up to speed about this subject matter, not only for our purpose, but for the general population. Because you'll hear people say, well, you know, that happened a long time ago. It was 18, you know, y'all been free since 1865. Y'all should be up to speed by now. But they don't really understand the systems that were put in place to hold people back, just like that contract that I read and that stipulation in number two, that it had to be Negroes. No other group has had to deal with that kind of racism in our country and on our shores. So when individuals say, y'all just need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, it's not that we hadn't been working and trying, but at every attempt to move forward, there's been things put in place to hold us back. But a lot of people don't understand that history. So part of it, and when we get funding for these things, when I was meeting with the city the other day, you know, the comment came up, well, I don't know if I could take tax dollars today to pay for something that happened in the 1880s. Oh, it's the point of view of the people that are controlling the purse strings. But my counter argument to him was that in today's age, the museum is going to attract visitors, tourists, and people that are thirsty for knowledge, which is then going to feed businesses in their community, restaurants. I mean, it's going to be a funnel of traffic through the hotels, restaurants.
So it's not just talking about the past. We're talking about educating people today and into the future, and this is going to be economic opportunity for you also. You know, we need to educate the people, but we need to, if we could get tapped into the revenue sources that are going to be continuous to fund the projects, we need to work that angle too. Yes, we need to own our own stuff. You know, one of the things that I wanted to mention, I heard someone say something about Jack Johnson, is that a lot of people today know more about the movie Black Panther and Wakanda than they know about real people like Jack Johnson from real places like Galveston, or real stories of like Sugar Land and the men that were part of that convict. Listen, we don't know the real history, so we believe in the make-believe as opposed to believing in the real. That will strengthen our history and individuals just like Jack Johnson, Jesse McGuire Dent, who was from Galveston, part of the founders of Delta Sigma Theta. And I just threw that in as a female that was instrumental in helping found the sorority is from our local area. But a lot of people don't know their local history and the local people, whether that's Philadelphia, all over the countries. You have real heroes in your community, and we need to stand up, tell their stories, and help our kids to realize you don't have to believe in the make-believe. You could draw strength from the real people. And as I was doing research on this, looking for this information, you know, I ran across some personal family history where my fourth great-grandfather first registered to vote in 1867 in Brazoria County, had been here 15 years. I think our children and our people need to know our own history so that we could draw strength. One of the things I hate to see young people do is say, I'm not my grandparents. Well, first of all, that's disrespectful to your grandparents. I am my grandparents. They survived something with the strength that I can't even imagine. You know, a system where you had no one to go to for help. They survived so that you could even exist. So I understand what they're trying to communicate to say, hey, I'm not going to take the abuse. I'm not going to take what some of those individuals took. But it's out of context because they're doing it from today's standard. If you were to go back in that period of time when you were getting picked up for vagrancy laws and there was no help, you said, well, I'm just going to fight back. There were people that fought back, and there were a lot of people that died fighting back. But at the same time, don't disrespect the history of the ancestors and those that came before you that had to survive so that you could exist. Everybody didn't jump off the ship. I understand in the Black Panther movie, Bury Me at Sea with my ancestors. I understand that, but also remember that those that survive, that's a strength in your DNA that you need to respect that strength. And don't. My grandmother didn't get a chance to go to Texas A&M University like I did. She can't read financial reports like I read. She doesn't know all this history. But I would never go into her home and disrespect her, because without her, I would not even be.
And let the church say amen.
Listen, we're going to take a brief break. Can you, man, stay over for a little bit? I know I kept you over time. Can you stay over for a few minutes more? Because, Mr. Collins, I want to ask you about some of those settlements that our people started after 1865 down in Texas.
Yeah, they were called colonists, and, you know, that came during Reconstruction. And we have one of the ladies, Andrea Roberts, professor. She's done some very in-depth studies in that. And
if you can't hold on till after the break, and then we'll take a few more questions before you men leave us this evening.
Okay.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're dealing with the story of our ancestors being uncovered in mass graves down in Texas. 95 of our ancestors were uncovered at a construction site, victims of convict leasing and forced labor. Mr. Moore and Mr. Collins have been doing yeoman work on that front, and they'll be back with us after the break to continue the conversation. When we come back from break, I meant to do it earlier, we'll be playing some selections from the Queen of Soul. Miss Aretha Franklin went home to join the ancestors on Thursday, late Wednesday night, Thursday morning. And the soul music is a original art form similar to jazz or blues that our people brought here to this country and established here when we were here in the land of our former chattel enslavement. And she personified that genre, soul music. And when you hear her singing, it goes straight to your soul. You know, listen, white folks can appreciate and listen to her songs and appreciate her talent, but they can't. They can't. That soul, that what she sung goes straight to the soul of black folks. And you'll hear some of the words of Miss Aretha Franklin and some of the songs that we're playing when we take a break. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can be involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for Awakening. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Me to love you if you won't let me. It ain't no way for me to give. If you're tired, both of my hands.
Back, it's time for an awakening. That's Ain't No Way by the Queen of Soul, Miss Aretha Franklin. Let's go right back to our guests and to the phones. Let's try 267 again. That's 267.
Hey, I'm just listening tonight.
Let's go to 646.
Hey, Elliot, is there a problem with tuning? Because this program isn't coming through.
Yeah, because there's several streams that it's on. If this is a problem with tuning, it'll be up on podcast. But do you have a question for our guest, Brother Jay?
The question basically is, with the bodies and stuff that they found, where did they move them to?
Well, they have. Am I here? Are you hearing me now?
Yes, Mr. Moore.
Well, they haven't. The body's in the process of being moved, and again, like I reiterated, I'm the guardian of a cemetery called the Old Imperial Center Cemetery, which is in eyesight of where the site is, where the 95 bodies are being have been found, and that's part of Fort Bend Independent School District site. And the city of Sugar Land owns another site, the cemetery and the land adjacent to this. And that's where we are planning to reinter the bodies at within a matter of a couple of months after the bioanthropology work has been done and the DNA studies and so forth have been concluded. Then that's where we are planning to inter them in. At that the time where they're at now, the studies and they're still excavating all of the bodies out as well. As we speak, all of them have been excavated, and all the forensics for studies haven't been finalized. As soon as they're finalized, we get another court order to exhume the bodies, and we'll be putting them in that cemetery that I just stated, the Old Imperial Central Cemetery, which is an eyesight of the 95 sites on the same tract of land.
Because, you know, in New York, they had a discovery years and years ago after the, it was the bombing down there, 9/11. And, you know, they had created, like, a memorial in that area. And I think they even stopped certain construction from happening on that land. But congratulations, and keep up the good work. Elliot, could you put me on mute, please?
Yes, sir.
And, thank you. Thank you for that, and, you know, for the callers calling in and for the interest in this. This is not a local or state. It's a national and international atrocity against crimes against humanity. I've had people call from Germany, from Canada, you know, abroad, and this and got millions and millions of hits, as I've been told, you know, for people who have an interest in this. And, you know, we all have something to be remorseful for, even the people in Africa, you know, who actually bordered our people into this, like Ghana had to repent for when they would take people into slavery, then the white settlers, the white merchants would come over, and the people who they had enslaved from when they were going take people of some other tribal things and put them under their tribe, then they would border them over and skin and to trade off of rum and other items to for the slave owners to come. So we have a lot of repenting to do, whether it's white or black, you know, and then some of us have repentance to do now for knowing the truth and not being advocates to step forward, because a lot of us are fearful restitution and retaliation as to what they did back in the day when you were standing up, when somebody was standing up for truth or justice, like Nat Turner and so forth, and groups would stand out, they would whip you. Instead of whipping you in front of the, what they caught you, they would bring you back and whip you in front of the other slaves to put fear in you. And that would put that Willie Lynch syndrome in us and make us fearful. And one thing I wanted to speak on with Miss Aretha Franklin is that she, when Dr. King was ostracized, when he did his April 4th, 1967 speech, and he said that America was the biggest purveyor of violence, and that, you know, we shouldn't be spending all our money on weapons. We should be spending our money on peace for the Poor People's Campaign. He was ostracized by a lot of the blacks, including the clergy and individuals who was for him. And his last 2 years were an oppressive time for him, along like Jesus did when he went against the organizations. They were against Aretha Franklin. When Dr. King came here to Houston, we had an event April the 4th that I hosted, honoring Dr. King as my mentor, as a follower of Christ, and Dr. King following that as putting the Poor People's Campaign. That's basically one of the things that I'm taking up in my mantle. And we had Dr. Thomas Friedman here, who taught Dr. King how to debate. F.M. Williams, one of the three ministers who supported him, because when he came, it was only three ministers that supported him. The rest of them ostracizing because he went against the government. And I see now that we still proponents of war, you know, as we do now, when only Barbara Lee stood up and we did some things in Iraq and on, and even Obama did some things that shouldn't have been done for us, Libya and Yemen. But when Dr. King was here, only Aretha Franklin, because he came here, he could not get the support that he needed. He couldn't fill a coliseum up. He had a lackluster support, and so he had to go back and reorganize, and that's when Aretha Franklin came here and used her advocacy. When a lot of the entertainers and groups and clergy and individuals went against him, Aretha Franklin, as an activist, came to Houston to promote Dr. King for the Poor People's Campaign. And that second attempt he did with Aretha Franklin, Harry Belafonte, he was able to galvanize the people after that, when he was being ostracized for his stand, you know, against the war and trying to advocate for peace just like Jesus was. So that's kind of where we stand on that, as far as our respect for Ms. Franklin and honoring her with Dr. King. An event that we had is, where do we go from here? Chaos or community? So that's just one of the things that we want to get recognized.
Yeah, thank you for
bringing
that up.
That's an interesting piece. I'm glad you shared that with us.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Collins,
go ahead.
Mr. Collins, before we leave this evening, the settlements after that Civil War ended, and you know, our people became aware, because Texas was considered the last state where a lot of our people found out what was going on. You had over 500 black settlements in the state of Texas. We know over the years, you know, white society and all just didn't allow these type of things. We've seen where some towns were attacked. Now, I don't know too much about what went on in Texas, but we know of some of the other documented attacks in other areas. But talk about the state of Texas and the settlements. Does any of the settlements still exist now? Of the 500, how many still exist? Give us a little background on that.
Yeah, the Texas Freedmen Colonies, and there's actually a website or a Facebook page. Dr. Andrea Roberts, who Mr. Moore spoke about, is more of an expert in this area.
Okay.
So I would encourage individuals to find that page, the Texas Freedom Colonies Project, and it's also the website is the same, the Texas Freedom Colonies Project. But what she writes about on that, there were, I think, 540, almost 550 freedmen towns or colonies in Texas, areas in which former enslaved individuals purchased land and started building their own communities. In my local area in Galveston County, there's one called the 1867 settlement, and that's where families started buying land in 1867. and establish churches, schools, and communities of their own. And I don't think, again, this is part of our real history that individuals don't understand what it took for those individuals to acquire land, start farming, start setting up businesses, to be self-sufficient and independent of the oppressors around them. They were able to have spaces where they could be truly free. In another town, Kendleton, I don't know exactly how many of the original freedmen colonies still exist.
Okay.
A great deal of them because of gentrification and areas being taken over don't exist anymore. There's a space in Houston, Freedman's Town, that has been under attack with development, you know, individuals coming in and buying up the land and tearing down the structures. But this is happening all over the country, to your point, that immediately following the end of slavery in 1865, there were individuals trying to set up their roots right in the communities because they had worked that land. They knew the land. They had the skills. You know, they set up the HBCUs, the colleges, the businesses. There were a lot of communities that were thriving. And unfortunately, an unintended consequence of integration was a total destruction of our business community in the sense that it dried up a lot of revenue that came through our community. So this 1867 settlement in Texas City, which was a thriving community at one point after the 1960s and 70s, you know, the businesses dried up as individuals took their dollars out of the community and started patronizing other businesses. And I often explain it like a river that runs through a village. If you redirect the flow of the water around the village, of course the village is going to dry up. Water is a source of life, and those revenues and the economics of that business help the community to thrive. That's why a lot of these communities are dying on the vine, and then also the children that inherit the houses and the land don't want to deal with it. They wanted to get away from the country. They wanted to move into the suburbs. They wanted to move into the city. And they left acres of diamonds on the ground, so to speak, of property that their ancestors had sacrificed to acquire. They just gave it away, you know, for pennies on the dollar, and didn't realize the wealth that was right beneath their feet.
We hear this so often on this program, Elliot, you know, with the black farmers making the same case.
And yeah,
it's a generational situation, but it's also a institutional transference of information also, which if we did more personal family genealogies would be helpful. If we were able to get it instituted in our schools, would be helpful in order to educate, you know, or at least make aware the importance of what did take place and why it's important to make certain kind of decisions now. But it's just interesting, also, the same thing over and over.
Yeah, I think also we have to also teach each other to have pride and hold our heads high about the elders and the ancestors that came before us. A lot of times we try to run away from this history. Slavery is something that happened to us. It wasn't who we were. It's something that happened to our ancestors. So we're not defined simply by that event, and individuals need to understand that, because oftentimes we run away from that history. And you know, I don't think we need to run away from it. I know we don't need to run away from it. We need to embrace the strength that it took to survive and pull on the strength of those individuals that came before. Could some things have been done different? Do we question some of the methods and the way they did it? But they did what they had to do to survive. And now, you know, we have people that won't even file a complaint on their job against their supervisor on social media behind the keyboard, acting like they some kind of activist, and you won't even stand up on your job and file a complaint against your supervisor.
You know, you won't even run for freedom to be free and try to start your own business because you're comfortable inside the system. And, you know, that's a whole nother conversation.
And freedom ain't free, and that's what I say. And this year we should have a great awakening where we, our people have been anesthetized, you know, and on that anesthesia. And what is it going to take to, maybe it has to be when somebody's in cardiac arrest, they put a defibrillator on them to shock us. We need some type of shock treatment to wake us up, because some of this is our worst enemy. And, you know, integration ended in the prisons, and the prisons were separated all the way into 1968. And, you know, we had our own businesses here. We had our own Black Wall Streets. And now today we only have one state bank in the state of Texas called the Unity Bank. And basically it's not in the same shape it was at one time. Here in Texas we had 32 banks, and we only have 32 banks, 31 to my understanding, in the whole United States. So we're going to have to empower our dollars. We're going to have to take our resources, you know, pull our fraternities, garages, and the money that we'll put in our church institutions, building buildings and so forth, where the churches, when Dr. King and Erlin came out of slavery, they had benevolent funds. They were supporters of the businesses that came out of the churches. And now we have more or less turned our churches, our operations into business and corporations, where we're not advocating for the last lease and the loss, where we're doing community development and we're uplifting our places, because we see right around some of our congregations these big edifices, but it's blight all around them. And we have an in-reach minister instead of an outreach minister, what Christ was about and Dr. King was talking about when he was ostracized. So we're going to have a great awakening. We're going to have to hold ourselves accountable. We're going to recreate the way they were doing reconstruction, and we need to be reconstructed as a people, as a group, and as a nation, where we can have some type of repentance and some type of revival, because the word says in 2 Chronicles 7:14, if those who call on my name will turn from their wicked ways, humble themselves, and repent, then they heal the land, but not until we have some repentance. And it's going to have to be some repentance for all the things and atrocities that America has done to the blacks, to the indigenous people, and what they're doing abroad, in order for her to come into her true acknowledgement. I'm proud of, I love America, but I don't like America for what she stands for. And it's hard for me to even stand for the flag. Stand up and turn my back to the flag, because I know what the flag done in Article 13 and what the flag did here legislating the convict lease system into law in 1866. I'm not proud of that. When you hear about that, that has to be some remorse, and America is not remorseful for what she's done. She's actually proud, as I say, when they call these areas Siena Plantation, Plantation Grove, and name streets and advocate for these individuals without recognizing the atrocity and inhumane conditions that they've dealt with people, and even took this land from Mexico and the Indians and what they did with the blacks. So that's where we kind of stand with that. Hopefully we'll have a, like your show said, an awakening, but I call it the Great Awakening, and I'm looking for hope and hoping that a change someday, like Sam Cooke say, someday, somehow, I knew a change was going to come, and I'm looking for that. I'm pessimistic, but I'm optimistic at the same time that it's going to be in a Great Awakening, and hopefully this year will be the revival that will bring America to her understanding of what she can repent for all of the things that she's done bad in the past and currently doing and advocating for as we speak today.
Well, I think that you and Mr. Collins are doing the work that's going to cause people, and our people in particular, to stand up and take notice to what's going on. Because just like you mentioned before, Mr. Collins, and we talked in private conversation, Mr. Moore, our people don't have the proper information to what's going on. We just don't. And that's it's reasons why that's to keep our people ignorant of things. It keeps other folks in power. But let me switch this a little bit before we start winding things down. Mr. Collins, you I understand that you did some work in getting Jack Johnson recognized in Galveston. A lot of our people really don't know too much about Jack Johnson, besides he was the first black heavyweight champion. I think he had the title from 1908 to 1911, if I'm not mistaken. But
1915.
Okay. Now, I found out a little bit more about Jack Johnson from the documentary that the guy, what Burns did a couple of years ago, Unforgivable Blackness. But talk about, because I know doing your research and just like Mr. Moore talked about earlier, by him doing his research, he felt close to these ancestors. When he went to that burial site, he could almost feel them. So by you doing research on Johnson, explain to the listening audience about Jack Johnson.
Yeah, I in 2005, I think that's when Burns' Unforgivable Blackness first came out. And I watched the documentary on PBS. Of course, being in the Galveston area, I had heard the story of Jack Johnson being the first heavyweight, African-American heavyweight champion. But I didn't really know as much about him until that documentary. And then I started researching myself and getting more involved in preservation in Galveston. And for me, Jack Johnson was an inspiration because he wanted to be the very best in his chosen field. And that's where I say all of our young people and people today could draw strength from the example of just wanting to be the very best at whatever you do. I don't care if you're a librarian, a street sweeper, a physicist, an engineer, accountant, teacher, whatever your profession is, just strive to be the best at it. And Jack Johnson was the best in the world, really probably from 1904-05, even though he didn't win the title till 08, up until 1915, because he won it from Tommy Burns in December 26, 1908, and then he defended it against Jim Jeffries in July 4th, 1910, in what was billed as the fight of the century at the time. But Johnson spoke several languages. He traveled around the world when most people didn't even travel more than 50 miles from their place of birth, and he lived by his own terms. You know, he was truly a free individual, not necessarily a champion for the African-American cause, because there were African-Americans that were upset with him for dating white women. There are still some today that feel like that took away from his accomplishment. But for him as an individual and just as a human being, it was his choice to live how he wanted to. What reason he had for that, you know, I can't dive into the mind of why he chose to go that way, but that was his freedom of choice. But again, him being the best in his field is an inspiration. And not only was he a great boxer, but the business of boxing. He negotiated his own contracts. He got paid over $100,000 for that fight in 1910, long before there was income tax where they would take a big chunk of your money. He was able to make his own money and keep his money. He bought over, I think, 27 or 28 plots in the cemetery in Chicago for his family. He was preparing for the future for his family, for children that hadn't even yet been born. He didn't have any children, but one of his sisters had children. There's still, I think, one or two plots in that cemetery available for the family that he paid for way back in the early 1900s. You know, that type of foresight and preparing for the future, we don't do it. He had an entourage of people that traveled with him that, I mean, the business side, he understood that. And then they used the legal system to convict him of the Mann Act, a violation of the Mann Act, which was trumped up charges. And now, of course, President Trump has given him the pardon. We had done some programming here. We wrote in to the president to try to get it done. Of course, Sylvester Stallone and the WBC carried more weight, and they're probably the part that got it over the hump. But we have been working on that for years. We had wrote President Obama. We had wrote President Bush. President Bush was from Texas. We thought he would do it. He didn't do it. President Obama was the first African-American president. We thought that he would be sympathetic, being the product of a biracial relationship and being the first African-American. Without Jack Johnson, there would not have been a President Obama. And some people say, Sam, you're reaching. That's unrealistic. But you got to think about how Jack Johnson moved the needle forward by becoming the heavyweight champion, a title in a position that was reserved for white males, that he was able to knock that door down and open up other opportunity. I mean, they were so upset about it that they crafted this law and convicted him of it, and no one else fought for the heavyweight title until Joe Louis in the 1930s. So it was 22 years before anybody even got a chance to fight for the heavyweight title. So some people say that, you know, Jack Johnson was the Ali of his time. No, Jack Johnson was the Jack Johnson of his time, and Ali was like Jack Johnson in the sense of his accomplishments in the ring that came along later, his confidence, the way he carried himself. He drew that strength from Jack Johnson. So I think because it happened so long ago, people just don't know that history, and they really should study his life. I mean, he had a couple of patents. Again, like I say, he spoke several languages. He played instruments. He was world renowned, and still today, he's the most famous native son of Galveston Island, but he was not celebrated on the island by the African American community or the white community because of what happened when he got convicted. There was some, you know, at one time they had an abstract art display that really didn't pay honor to him, but now they have a park. They have a marker in place. The Texas Historical Commission approved what they call a subject marker that they put in place where the state paid for it because the group in Galveston had never put up a historical marker. So the state of Texas actually approved one, paid for it, and put it in Galveston. In Galveston County, Texas, should really celebrate this individual. And we're doing better about it now. But for a long time, he wasn't celebrated.
And that's what you had to forgotten. And Jack Johnson also, he was a longshoreman. The first convict lease system started in 1867 in Galveston. And those guys were, he was a longshoreman, and they were doing the work of unloading the ships and all, because Galveston was a port city and actually was a state capital one time. The high school I went to, it's called Yates High School in Third Ward, and right next to it is called, it's a subsidized housing project called CUNY Homes. And the arrow came from James CUNY, them who were actual longshoremen during that period of time, which started the Port of Houston here in the Black Longshoremen Association. And Jack Johnson was a longshoreman, and I'm a retired longshoreman, and I'm working with a gentleman named Ted Irvin and at Yates and the vocational plan, and we're trying to, you know, get things done there, donated forklifts, and they're trying to get that vocational program going and the Maritime Academy to enrich that, because that area of Third Ward is being gentrified out in the same place that's named after James CUNY, who's one of the longshoremen, and have a site in Galveston of a cemetery there where they actually bought plots from that organization that came out of that Longshoremen Association, which Jack Johnson was first a longshoreman before he got into boxing, that originated out of there. And so that's a little bit more of that history that came out of Galveston that was so significant. And during that Reconstruction era, after they came out of slavery, during that work for slavery, during Reconstruction, the blacks were very powerful. And we need to make note of the era of Reconstruction, and that's another area of thought that needs to be brought out, how Reconstruction, how blacks did so much for the Texas and the United States during Reconstruction, when they actually reconstructed Texas and the United States and all the companies that benefited from the Kempner Fund, the Kempner families, a lot of these banks, institutions, Bank of America, Chase funded this, the railroad companies, everybody benefited from that, should be able to pay some type of restitution for this to help us to rebuild what they took from us during Reconstruction, during slavery. Because, after the blacks had their freedom for about 20 years, they took this back from them. They went to the new Jim Crow because they didn't like the fact that we were, had the votes and all, and that was taken away. But right there in Galveston, he did a whole lot of work, and Jack Johnson came out of that lineage, and those guys are proud here today as black longshoremen here in Texas and Houston. And that started out of Galveston with James CUNY and an organization that that also created Jack Johnson. I think he got some of his work ethics prowess to help him become the champion that he became.
Before you men leave us this evening, give out any information how people can support, if possible, how they can get involved, any websites, any social media, anything you, that you want to give. Go ahead, the floor is yours, man.
We have a email here, and we're creating our website as we speak today, and we'll come back probably another time to speak with you guys. But our email here is convictcllp@gmail.com. And you can pull my research work up that has a lot of this work here, and the news clippings and all the reports at Rice University, and you can pull up Reginald Moore, Sugarland Convict Lease, and you can find a lot of that work that can lead you to all the research and documentation that I was able to acquire in the research work and advocacy that I've been doing in with the Convict Lease and the other areas of endeavors that I've been advocating for social justice reform. And so you can pull a lot of that up. And you know, Sam, believes, you know, has a contact with that doing the Galveston there, but you can
I have
them together.
I have a historic site called Stringfellow Orchards. So the website is www.stringfellow, STRINGFELLOW, Orchards, ORCHARDS.com. So that's one word together, stringfelloworchards.com. All my contact information is there. If you go on YouTube and do a Google search, Sam Collins, you can see my speech I gave at the Texas Sports Hall of Fame on Jack Johnson and some other video there. But that's my contact information at stringfelloworchards.com.
And I also
and
we're
looking for anybody who, especially big endowments, you know, local and national and international, and that we can help pull our legislative and our representatives from the local, state, and the U.S. representatives to get some type of recognition up there and change the Article 13 and make America give some type of restitution for initiating this federal law that became state laws that reinstitutionalize our people. So America itself has a debt to pay. And Dr. King said that he gave us that check, we sent that check and came back insufficient funds. They have plenty of funds. They're selling properties here from the these prison systems that here locally and closing them down. The one that I'm over, the Central Prison, has closed down a few years ago, and the Jesse units. Those are properties that are going into, they call the state aid, the education fund, but it ends up going into a rainy day fund. And those are dollars that can be given back, and all the dollars that America's spending on wars, like the King said. If we take some of that money and give back to what we did with that Article 13, it needs to be an apology. And we need to have a federal apology, a local or state apology for what they instituted and what they legislated from the federal and local and state perspective. So we're asking if you know any endowments, any groups, any dollars that we can advocate from on a local and an international level, then we need to have that done and to help support getting this museum and this memorial bit built so that we can have endowments that can sustain this so that this truth will never die and this will never happen again.
Mr. Collins, Mr. Moore, I want to thank you for being with us, and I'll be in touch with both of you men very shortly.
It was an honor and a privilege to be there, and thank you for this. And we want to keep hope alive, and hopefully we can have a great awakening and a rejuvenation to bring us closer together, to live up to what we didn't live up to, and to honor our ancestors.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, man.
Take care now.
All right, bye.
We're going to take a brief break. Richard, we're going to start winding things down, but when we come back, I want to share with you something that you had been talking about before, about the color conventions, but I want to share with you something that they said about this particular subject. We'll come back from break and we'll talk about it. And for the time we have left, if you want to get involved in the conversation, you can dial 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough.
Believe me,
believe me.
For me there is
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. I want to thank our guest this evening that was with us, that spent some time with us, Mr. Reginald Moore and Mr. Sam Collins III, talking about their work uncovering the atrocities that happened to our ancestors down there in Sugar Land, Texas, and some of the other sites that that Mr. Moore is doing work on now that I'll kind of let those things come to the surface. I won't talk about those. In fact, I'll let him come on and talk about some of those things in the future. But it's other areas where these things happened to our ancestors that Mr. Moore and Mr. Collins are working on. But that's work that that needs to be brought to the surface, Richard, that our people need to know about. It's kind of ironic that Mr. Collins said that he wasn't aware of a lot of these things, and he's right down there in Texas. You know, that goes to what we've been preaching on this program, Richard, about the need for our people to have information. That verse that I quote when we start the program, that our people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. That's what it is. Mm. And this system that we live under intends to keep our people ignorant.
Yes, it does.
That's why we need to use these airwaves just to do, do what we do. You know, we don't have time. This is my opinion, and I think it's backed up by evidence. All you have to do is look at the state of some of our people, that we don't have time for laughing and giggling 6 and 7 days a week with charlatans and minstrel shows like Steve Harvey's and Tom Joyner's and their wannabes laughing and giggling 7 days a week. It ain't nothing that damn funny.
And even when we talk about the whole thing of building wealth and not really placing in context, you know, the wealth that we hadn't fought for, it, you know, and I get on a diatribe, and I won't do it now, you know, Elliot, but, you know, we continue to hear from the guests that we have on a continuous theme of how the intergenerational delinking that has occurred, you know, around from one generation to the next. And Mr. Collins, particularly, you know, making this plea that the younger people not disrespect the experience and the age and the moment of those elders more than celebrate it, you know. But this delinking, we keep hearing about this in so many different levels or at so many different points. It's really, that's another important part as far as you're saying of why those two elements, why that our people don't have the information because of the intentional laughing and joking from what is being propagated, it being so now in the various platforms, television, radio, digital, video, virtual, on and on and on, these to keep us away from that connection.
Richard, you know, something that you had brought up before in past programs, and you talked about the colored conventions that they would have, especially during the period of the forced bondage of our in the 19th century. And the thing about it, when you look back and see those colored conventions, you had free members of our people that were advocating for their brothers that were in chains. It wasn't about, listen, I got my life, you deal with yours. They had the same care one for another. They were advocating, the free blacks, free ancestors of ours were advocating for their brothers and sisters that were enslaved. And those colored conventions went all over. They were in the North, they were in the South. Now, the one I wanted to read was in reference to our subject matter tonight. Now, Mr. Moore told us that right after the Civil War was over and they instituted the Black Codes, that they turned this convict leasing over to two individuals that had been Confederate generals or whatever, this Ed Cunningham and L.A. Ellis. Now, they ran that convict leasing system from 1872 to 1883, and the state took it over. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine how much money that those two individuals made during that 12-year period before the state said, well, wait a minute, we want to get on, mm-hmm. we want to get involved in some of this money, and they took it over.
Like the lottery.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. They hit the lottery with all, and what he stated about, you know, during the chattel enslavement, some of these quote-unquote slave masters had a vested interest to at least keep our ancestors somewhat relatively healthy. But during that convict leasing, they didn't care whether you worked them into death, because they had plenty of other people that they were, every time you looked, they were grabbing somebody else for vagrancy, for not having an ID, for not having a job, and all this other stuff. But I want to read to you the minutes, because during the colored conventions, they dealt with different subjects during the period of the convention. I want to read to you a portion of the minutes. It's a historical document, a portion of the minutes that they talked about in 1883 in Austin, Texas. They had the colored convention. And they talked about just what we're, the subject matter that we talked about this evening. I want to read to you some of the minutes, because they dealt with a lot of things, free schools, buying land. They had different workshops, and I guess you could use the term workshops, dealing with different subject matter. Now, I'm going to read to you what they stated in reference to what we're talking about this evening. It says, another sore grievance that calls for the consideration of this convention is the treatment of convicts, a large portion of whom are colored. It is inhuman and cruel and is extreme. We do not refer to those that are kept within walls. They are under the immediate care and supervision of management, and we believe considerately treated. But most of the convicts are scattered over the state of Texas on farms, having no one to administer to their physical, moral, or spiritual needs, but a host of inhuman, brutal convict guards. When a fresh convict is carried, now listen to what they state in the minutes, Richard. Wait a minute, I lost my place. When a fresh convict is carried to the farms, he is taken down by the other convicts and beaten at the command of the guards, and that too with a large piece of cowhide. The guards take this method of taming the newcomer, of course, that lays him up, but a few days he's hauled out of the sick quarters and put to work, whether he's physically able to do it or not. The law provides that a convict physically unable to work shall not be required to do so. Such inability to be asserted by examination of the penitentiary physicians. But convicts on farms and plantations who are mostly colored have no physician to determine such inability. And even when sick or dying, unless the hiring planter, who has no particular interest in saving his life, sees fit to employ a doctor, then they don't see any. In many cases, sick convicts are made to toil until they drop dead in their tracks. Many, again, driven to desperate and inhuman treatment, seek to relieve themselves by attempting to escape when the chances are against them, thus inducing the guards to shoot them, which they are ready to do at the slightest pretext. So you're talking, I mean, they talked about this in the minutes of the
first hand observation.
Exactly.
First, right there.
In fact, it says here in this other paragraph, in 9 out of 10 cases, parties were sent to investigate these occurrences and report the killing, unjustifiable killings by these guards and their friends, and find it convenient to make it appear so. When the legislative committee visits one of these convict camps, they always find the convicts ready to report that they are being treated well, because all of them are previously warned by their guards to, if they report such acts, the consequences on which would follow. So, I mean, we see what was going on. And, you know, I just thought it was, necessary to read that, because some of these men had care for their brethren, even though they were in this situation. They knew what was going on in the state of Texas and how this was rampant in Texas, you know, with sugar cane and other crops that they were dealing with. They still wanted slave labor, even after, quote unquote, slavery had ended.
It's a piece that, and I kind of mentioned it, and I'm on this kick, Elliot, you know, because this whole thing of the moving from enslaved labor to convict leasing labor, or to exploitation of Africans in the labor pool, and even when we talk about the union thing, we're continuing that discussion, that kind of lineage within America's system. But one thing that got me, Elliot, when we talk about the Constitution and this here process then, is the point of, you know, the commodification of African bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Brother Moore was alluding to that this, well, Brother Collins, when he said that contract that he found, said specifically, you know, to it would had to be Negroes,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, so here again, the continuation of our bodies, our being, and this is where I think the political part really gets, some people might say deep, but it gets that, you know, what we have to raise up a lot, because at what point did we not become a commodity with an open market? Because that prison system obviously had a market for that. Now, and it's nice to call it labor, right? Which he said that they had to call it labor because they couldn't say slaves, right?
Mm-hmm.
So and African people are the only ones in this country whose body, whose being, not just their body, but their whole person was a commodity, you know, compared to indentured. Indentured, you was under a contract. African people were bought and sold as a actual instrument, like, you know, with value, like a credit card. And actually being that property, actually being able to have a market for it to be sold. No other people in this country had to go through that, has been identified as that. So convict leasing to me is a continuation of that in another form. It ain't just the 13th Amendment, you know, that you have, because even in that is what they're saying in that Article 13, if you're placed under the criminal justice system, then some of your rights as a citizen, which you're supposed to have gotten, right, you know, out of the 14th Amendment, your rights as a citizen is null and void, right? So here we're dealing with something with us that is deeper than just using our labor to make someone else wealth. At, you know, the question of being property that had value and having a market, we're talking about business and accounting. And that's what we're addressing. And that's why it seems to me the putting the Harveys or you know, Mr. Moore was talking about the difficulty to get in the school system by Black people.
Yeah, he did
the
mention
NAACP
that.
Not wanting to support, the Urban League not wanting to support, not even being able to put those records into a Black university or a historically Black college. This thing is, you know, when we're talking, I hope the listening audience follow up on this, because it gets into a broader discussion of what our place is in this country for those who are awakened.
Yeah, that's why these things have to be, you know, Nellie Fuller, Frances Quest Welsing sometimes, God rest her soul, used to mention about not criticizing our people. But, you know, I don't agree with that. I agree with a lot of things that they stated, both of them. But I don't agree with that. When you got our people out there that's working against the interests of other black people, they have to be exposed. They have to be exposed because they can cause damage. That's why Harriet Tubman kept a pistol with her when she was delivering people out of bondage. Because somebody that wanted to turn back, they wasn't turning back as far as she was concerned. Because when you do that, then the next thing you know, her life is in jeopardy. Mm. So, I mean, these people that do that, this type of stuff, they have to be exposed. They have to be talked about. And they have to be ostracized. It has to be penalties. A lot of these people don't feel as though there's no penalties when they do their people wrong, other black people. Or so what? Because they figure that they can run back to the community and find some type of solace or curry favor. Look at the perfect example of this Omarosa. The same thing with her. I mean, she was in this man's court espousing the values of this guy, but as soon as they kicked her to the curb, then all of a sudden she needs a friend in the black community again. And some of our people are ready to accept her. When are we going to learn about this type of behavior?
Well, it definitely shows what we have to do in the sense of, you know, whether it be through mediums like this or other mediums on the ground or even political activists. I see the sister from D.C. is online and listening. And one thing that Brother Moore is advocating is for, you know, not just an apology, but he feels a reparation.
Yeah, he said reparations.
Yeah, this notion that where there should be some kind of redress, although that comes out of our effectiveness and us being able to mobilize and organize our people with this information. Because until we are able to do that, you know, and the color conventions, as you mentioned, is a prime, that didn't, you know, what you say, that was 1883? Was that 83?
1883.
You know, those conventions started in 1835.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So these men and women were coming together and creating policies and strategies and platforms, you know, for over 50 years. And when the opportunity, and so it's not, they were clear in looking around what was going on. You know, and that was before, I see Brother Otis brings up about gate. That was before the gatekeepers, not saying they weren't, there were those there, but that was before the amount of gatekeepers we have now, because we have a whole lot now that are, you know, defending and not informing, so that we can be able to make choices or create policies. But, all of that, us being having the information is no good if we can't mobilize and organize effectively using the tools that are at hand. We can have differences. And that's what those, you know, if you look at those conventions, they all of them weren't on the same page. They argued. They had different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
But they came to a conclusion because they knew what they were dealing with, what they were up against. The reason we don't have no ability to reprimand or to deal with people like the Omarosas at the national level or those at the local level, because we don't have no mechanisms even to come together to agree on something, even to show our disagreement and then walk out as one body on what we're going to deal with and stick to that.
And stick to it, yeah.
You know, so that's the, you know, other dimension to the challenge that we have before. And this gives us the opportunity to be able to share that, you know. So asking for reparations, wanting to provide the information, all these things become critical things for us to be able to even move for those of us who see sovereignty as the only answer. But they mentioned Santa Ana. That was a sovereign nation. And they had explicitly said, in this nation, no slavery will be upheld.
Mm-hmm.
And what did these boys do? They did it anyway. You hear me?
Mm.
Which made them have to go to war. So, and they were willing to go to war. That's how, so we can't look at this as no lightweight thing when we're talking about our redress and our grievance, even to the point of, because I, you know, even Malcolm said that we should go to the UN under the for human rights violations,
mm-hmm.
right? And bringing that up, you know, another person that passed was one of the only African, first African that was a part of the UN, Kofi Annan.
Yeah,
you know, but that's, this is, I kind of say that, Elliot, because I don't want us to think that this is some one dimension kind of approach we have to deal with. If we just become aware, we have to become informed, aware, overcome our ignorance so that we can be able to mobilize, organize, and defend our position.
It's a must. You got a few minutes to clear this board?
Yes, sir.
Let's go to 816. 816?
816. Hey, Brother Elliot, how you doing this morning?
How are you,
this
sir?
Evening? I'm okay. Brother Richard, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine. How you doing, man?
I'm okay. I caught the tail end, but I did read that article when it occurred about, 2 months ago, when it was all kind of getting reported all over social media. The mainstream media really didn't cover it.
I know it.
To.
Yeah. Okay.
And, I think that's a key piece. That's an integral piece in our history. It often gets overlooked. I know we looked at the film 13th came out talking about modern day slavery, but that's a key piece of our history. As a matter of fact, a documentary that PBS came out with about 10 years now. It's been about 10 years now. It's called Slavery by Another Name.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And that went deep into the convict leasing and the peonage, as they called it. They use that term too, peonage, to kind of talk about it more and how the modern day jail system kind of came about. So just a very important piece of history that, you know, I myself have to study just a little bit more, the mechanisms of it. I know pretty much the macro of it, about how basically slaves, you know, how they basically passed laws that they knew that the newly, what they would call newly freed peoples, they knew would entrap them, basically, with the vagrancy laws and the just being out after a certain period of time, and railroads, and just all of these things. And so it's a very unique history. The one other thing I wanted to touch on is what you guys were talking about just here, just a couple minutes ago. It's very important that I like what Richard said, was come to a conclusion. We can have our differences, but come to a conclusion. We need to come to conclusions on the matter. And we have it. Brother Elliot, I like what you're doing. You started around, I want to say, football season, especially what you're talking about with the exposing people, with Jenkins of the Philadelphia Eagles, the cornerback.
Okay.
You started calling it out. And I know it rubbed some people the wrong way, because I remember that podcast and some people disagreed. But if you look and observe and take just the outside approach and study what's been going on with just our people in general, our people are starting to, in a way, especially with these white people calling the police on us, our people are starting to identify people who, as Dr. Clyde Anderson called it, we're going to call it this, inappropriate behavior. And I think, you know, I couldn't even see it then what you were talking about. I was more on what you were talking about with Neely Fuller, kind of, you just kind of want to focus on the people who are doing, who are seem to be doing the majority correct decisions. Don't focus on people with the inappropriate behavior or cooning or timing, as some of the commentators say now. But like you said, that is very important.
Yeah.
Because of that, black people, I don't know if people even realize it, we are having an energy about us right about now. I know it's, I hate using that word because it's hard to quantify, but we are having kind of sort of an energy where we're even just normal, everyday black people who are not listening to forums like this, they're starting to call that out. And it's a good thing. Look at Dak Prescott. You know, I just talked about Jenkins. Look at what happened with Dak Prescott. Mm-hmm. We have mainstream, we even have rappers calling the behavior out. And we need that.
Yeah.
You're right. We do need that. We can't just sit idly by and just kind of let inappropriate, which is, let's take it to another, detrimental behavior in a pattern of behavior by individuals or apparatuses within our community. We can't sit by and just go, oh, well, you know, we're going to focus on this. We're not going to. No, we need to call it out.
Mm-hmm.
We do need to call it out because that energy is morphing. It's morphing. It happened with Maxine Waters and the white supremacists. Unfortunately, we know what happened that weekend with the lives lost. You know, that just shows us the enemy is calculating, which we need to get up on. But other than that, our people are starting to call it out, and that energy is vitally important because they're getting the strength to do that. So I just want to comment on that. And I appreciate you, brothers, for taking my call.
Hey, thank you for your contribution, man.
Chat it.
Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Let's go to 215. 215.
Hey, how, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
Hey, Brother Richard, how y'all brothers doing tonight?
Good.
Praise be to Allah. You know, first I want to say this, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. This show is usually, I listen to Mr. Moore and Mr. Collins, and I say they respectfully because they're my elders and stuff. And it's funny, it's ironic, Elliot, that you had these brothers on because in the current issue, the final call that got about, where they got the headline about how Almighty God is punishing America with all these fires and all this, you know, bad weather. And then they got an article about the Sugarland, Texas situation that you was discussing with Mr. Collins and Mr. Moore. I haven't read it yet, but I got it right in front of me, as a matter of fact. I'm going to read it, you know, right after the conclusion of y'all's show. But it's ironic, yeah, I say, Ellie, you're always on time. You and Richard are always on time, man. Yeah, you know, and so I just want to thank y'all for having, like I said, Mr. Collins and Mr. Moore on, because they was talking about exactly what y'all, in the final call, reporting exactly what y'all was talking about tonight. Treatment of our people in Sugarland, Texas, with the laborers and the slave labor and the brutality, and like, Mr. Moore said the atrocity against humanity, you know.
Well, let me say this, Joe. You know, we just brought the men to the air so they could tell the people. Those are the men that deserved it because, like Mr. Moore was saying, he suffered physical, you know, problems behind putting himself out there like this.
Yes, sir.
So those men deserve all the accolades, all the credit.
Yes,
and they're not looking for any accolades or credit because nobody does this. Listen, it's nothing monetary in it for you. Unlike people like Omarosa and all, where it's something monetary in it for them, so they do certain things. It's nothing monetary in what these men are doing. They're doing it because they care.
Right,
they care for our people.
Exactly. They got love for our people. Unlike Omarosa, who's nothing but a hustler. Like you say, she only running back here like all them Negroes do when a white man kick up there behind and he come running back because the white man, like Minister Farrakhan said, he throw you back in the laps of your people and stuff, you know. And now, I want to thank you, too, for playing a song by our late queen of soul, Aretha Franklin, several minutes ago. I say a little prayer for you because, as you know, Brother Elliot and Richard, no matter what religious faith you are in, or what kind of, whether it's Islam, Christianity, Judaism, you know, African spirituality, whatever, you know, higher faith if you believe in, I think it's safe to say we all need a little prayer for us. You know what I mean? We need, matter of fact, we need a lot of prayer. But I appreciate you saying that because there's a system. And may God be pleased with Sister Reed, because that sister was so deep. I mean, she, as you know, she supported Dr. King and stuff. She helped fund him and stuff. She put a lot of finance behind Dr. King and also Brother Elliot and Brother Richard into the Time for the Wake and Listen Order. Sister Rita also helped, you know, pay bail money and lawyer and legal fees for Sister Angela Davis. You know, I mean, for a black person to do that, especially during that time, that was deep, because, you know, to put yourself out there like that. But the sister had courage. That's why I have number love and respect for the Queen of Soul, because she was a beautiful sister and she's going to be missed. But she may be gone physically, Brother Ellen Richard, but her spirit will be with her forever. You know what I mean?
Cause I wanted to add that I seen that there was an Ebony article where she provided the support for Mosque Number 12 when they had the shake up in New York there, and that okay. It's just interesting, you know, when you look at the dimensions of those entertainers like Sister Rita, you know. There are activism.
Yes, exactly, Brother Rick. That's why I say the sister get number 11 and respect and props from me for being a stand-up sister that she was. I mean, because like she put herself out there like that. And you find that far and free between the day with some of these Negroes in the entertainment and sports world. And to Brother Elliot, he was talking to Brother Jay a couple weeks ago about P.J. Tucker. Now, see, again, you know, people can make the argument where he can do what he wants with his money. Sure, and look, a fool can do what they want with their money. But when you do foolish things, you expect foolish returns. Now, for this brother to sit there and buy all these expensive sneakers when he's getting free sneakers, buying $500 worth of a $200 pair of sneakers when you got black folks around you dying and living in abject poverty. I want to take a salute, Brother Richard and Brother Elliot, to Brother Preston. I think his name, Brother Preston 2X, from Mosque Number 45, if I'm correct, is the current issue of the final call in New Orleans, Louisiana. This brother, to him and his wife, they got two businesses. They got like a cleaning janitorial business, and they got a real estate investment business. That brother did around Mosque Number 45 in New Orleans, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Him and his wife were a lot of the abandoned houses, ran down houses, and they fixed them up and made them nice homes, not no slum, for those slumlord type stuff, good homes for black folks. And he rent them out with decent rent, and he charged these people decent rent. And all the homes is right around Mosque Number 12. Mosque Number 45 in New Orleans. So he has helped beautify the neighborhood. And at the same time, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, he has put black folks in nice homes. So black folks got nice homes to live in. You know what I mean? And so that's why I say P.J. Tucker, he would better serve the investors' money, because he's going to get a big return back on his money, knowing he's putting black folks in these homes to buy some damn $300 sneakers, making some white cracker rich all over the damn United States and the world, making the Nikes and the Adidas and all these other people rich at the expense of poor people, making sneakers for 3 cents an hour and all that kind of foolishness and stuff like that. And like you said, LA, they get free sneakers anyway. As an NBA player, you get so much allotment of free sneakers, as much as you really want when it comes down to it. You know what I mean? So to sit there and buy into that foolishness when your money could be better served. Another brother I want to salute, remember Brother Derek Coleman Elliott and Richard, to play for the Sixers, Derek, D.C.? Mm-hmm. He did the same thing up in, I think, in New York or wherever. I forgot where D.C. is from. I think it's New York, one of them, Chicago.
From
one
Detroit.
He did this. In Detroit. He did the same thing in Detroit. Brother Derek Coleman put a whole bunch of abandoned houses, and he got them fixed up, and he put black people in those houses, so black people got a decent home to live in. Because at the end of the day, when you have food, clothing, and shelter, that's basically all you need, man. Food, clothing, and shelter. And Brother Derek Coleman did that. So I say to Brother P.J. Tucker, he would be better served by taking his money and buying up houses and putting black folks in it. And stuff, instead of that foolishness and stuff that he contributed to our foolishness. Because, like I say, a fool and his money will soon depart. Because, see, one thing these brothers don't understand, Brother L.A. and Richard, they find out the hard way. You might be making $20 million a year playing basketball now, but you're not going to make that forever. If you're constantly spending your money on stupid stuff, buying 20 cars, $500 pair of sneakers at $300 or $400 pair of sneakers at one given time, sooner or later that money will disappear. And if you don't think you can be broke, look at some of these other brothers that have made that kind of money, and they sitting there broke. The Antonio, the Walker, would play for Boston, Antoine Walker, all them guys broke. You know, broke as I don't know what, made millions of dollars, over $100 million playing pro basketball, and yet they broke now. Because, again, like the old folks saying back in the day, a fool and his money will soon depart. If you don't think it's true, you'll learn the hard way. You know what I'm saying? So I just say these brothers need to stop being more wise with their money and start doing things that's going to be more beneficial to their people. This is why white folks laugh at us, because white folks have generational wealth. White folks pass insurance policies from generation to generation. If it's not in the trust, it's in some kind of life, variable life policy where when they die, their grandchildren become rich. And after their grandchildren live on and they have children or grandchildren, they become rich. So from generation to generation, these white folks keep generational wealth. Black folks, this is what we need as a people, generational wealth. And damn it, we sure earned it. We worked free for the white man all these years. We damn sure need to have some generational wealth for our people, man. And stop being so damn foolish with our money. You know what I'm saying? Stuff with that, you know. And I just thank you for your time, Ellen and Rich. I know y'all got to get off soon, so I want to thank y'all for giving me the time.
Thank you for your call.
You're welcome. Peace.
Let's take this last call. Let's go to D.C. Hello, sister.
Hi, this is Sister Sean. How you doing, Elliot?
Great.
Okay. Reggie, welcome back.
Richard. Richard.
I think I missed Richard.
This is Richard, yes.
Okay, I think I missed Cynthia McKinney. I was trying to get on at the same time that she was on, but what I want to say is that down here from Washington, D.C., this is Sister Sean. I'm a member of the 1 Million Conscious Black Voters and Contributors, working with Jim and Amafika, Jim Kleeman and Amafika Geuka. But down here, we've got some real stuff going on, and I'm so excited, and I wanted to talk to her about this. We've got, and we're pushing for a reparations bill to be on the ballot in November. We've got the signatures. We'll know by tomorrow whether or not it's contested or anything is contested, but our candidate will be on the ballot in the District of Columbia. And we have a form of reparations for Black people. It is real. We are working for it actively. It's called the DC Recovery Act. And John Cheeks is going to be running to try to unseat Eleanor Holmes Norton. We don't have any aggression towards her. The only thing is that she does not support reparations. But John Cheeks does. So I'm very, very excited about this. We've been working diligently to make it happen, and what we're trying to do is to get it done and be successful so we can use it as a template in a business model. So if we can get it done here in DC, we can use the same business model in Detroit, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Chicago, everywhere. We're changing the political strategy. We're using the same methods here in the District of Columbia. I don't know if you know, but let me just tell you. We've got, we've got the gay same-sex marriage bill, and we've got the marijuana bill, all legal here in the District of Columbia. We're using the same strategy that they use to get same-sex marriage and marijuana legalization. We're doing it by what you call a referendum, a question referendum. That way, no candidate really has to be attached to it, but if you could do the work to put it in on your ballot as a question, it becomes law.
So that's the secret,
that's what we need to be doing. And we're going to try it in November, and we're going to get that question on the ballot, but we're calling it recovery. We're going to get that question on the ballot, just like they got legalization of marijuana on the ballot, and just like they got same-sex marriage on the ballot.
So you did get enough signatures? You did get enough signatures, you said, to have it?
Yes, sir. And tomorrow is a big day. So tomorrow we'll know whether or not it's contested. We've been working to get the signatures. Tomorrow the clock runs out. If it's not contested, he will be on the ballot. He will be on the ballot, and he is actually the sponsor of the bill. So I'm very, very excited and happy. And I also would like to say on this phone call, I don't want to really put too much out there, but what I do want to say is that everything in terms of getting this done, if we're successful, we've had collaboration from other organizations outside the 1 million. I would say like four of the organizations, including Dr. Claude Anderson, and COBRA, Dr. Evans. And I'm really, really proud of that because we get a lot of talk that we're not collaborating. For the first time, I saw these organizations be unselfish, and to lend, you know, a hand in this effort. But Elliot, I'm going to have to call you after tomorrow, because what we're going to do once he gets on that, if he gets on that ballot, and if we don't get uncontested tomorrow, we have to have a full-fledged promotional campaign to make sure we get everybody in the District of Columbia. I don't care if you're in Philadelphia, California, you got people working even outside the state. Anybody that you know in the District of Columbia, you get this bill passed, just like they passed marijuana and just like they passed the same sex marriage. So if they can do it for those type of issues, there's nothing in my life that's going to tell me that they can't do it for reparations. So we're using the same strategy, and it's different. It's different. It's a new strategy because, see, a lot of times these politicians, they're full of fear. They fake. They don't want to grasp themselves or attach themselves to anything related to reparations. But the trick is get it as a question, as a referendum. That way nobody is attached to it and let the voters decide. So when they go in that voter group, same thing like they do with gay marriage, not gay marriage. Yes or no. That's it. And then that way it gives them like a little out because, you know, they're fearful in the political system and they don't want to be attached to anything that is related to reparations. I mean, that's just the facts. That's just the truth. Our politicians, they're fearful. They don't have no backbone. So this is a new strategy that we think will work. And we're actually following the same strategy that they did for marijuana and gay marriage. So we sat back and we thought, if they can get it done for these two issues without people or candidates really attaching themselves to it and just get it straight to the people, let the people decide, do you want recovery or don't you? Do you want marijuana or don't you? Do you want gay marriage or don't you? That's what we're trying to do. And we're like 75% there. After tomorrow, we will really, really know where we stand. And 5 p.m. tomorrow, when the business board of elections close, we're all on standby. Once that's done, I'm going to be digging in, and everybody else, whoever I can galvanize around me, to dig in to get this done and get this voted and target the voters of the District of Columbia to say yes to the Recovery Act. It is a form of reparations. Once we get that done, it can be used as a blueprint, and then we can work with other states to do the same thing in their state.
Well,
I would love Cynthia McKinney. I know her pretty much all my life, never spoken to her at all, but I would love an opportunity to speak with her, Elliot, and to let her, I mean, to get her advice, because she's been in the U.S. House of Representatives, and she knows the ropes. She definitely knows the ropes. She's been there, done that. And I totally respect her. And I would love to have an opportunity to speak with her.
Oh, well, yeah, well, we'll talk. Because I want you to come back next week and let us know how things went this Tuesday. So, yeah, we'll get things together.
Tomorrow is the big day. Everybody, I want everybody to pray for us. Tomorrow's the big day. If we're non-contested, his name will be on the ballot.
Sister Sean, I want to make sure I got the point of clarity about that. The signatures that are being reviewed tomorrow, is it to have the brother on the ballot, or is it to legitimize the question to be on the ballot?
No, we've already passed that phase, and it's a phase in the electoral process right here. First of all, before you could even be considered to run for office. Basically, he's running for office to unseat Eleanor Holmes Norton.
Right, that's one. Is that separate from the question being put on the ballot? Because I know you have to go through a process to have a question put on the ballot.
Yes, sir. Separate from the question. So the first hurdle we had to do was to get the signatures. Right. Okay, so first of all, you got to get the signatures. And we did that two Wednesdays ago. You had the minimum is like 3,000 signatures, but we went out and we lobbied boots on the ground. We got an extra 1,000.
And that is for him to be placed on the ballot.
Right. That's phase one. Place on the ballot. And the reason why you need extra signatures is because you get down near the board of elections and they'll start throwing signatures out. This is no good. This is not a registered voter. This person got a felony. We already know. You know that process. So that's why you need more than enough signatures. So the small victory was with our signatures were good enough to be even considered to be on the ballot. So now the next phase is once you pass that hurdle, the next phase is what they call a period of an open period contesting. So in other words, there's an open period. We're in the open period right now. The open period started last Wednesday. If you're going to contest, okay, it's like if you're going to contest the candidate for any reason, whatever, I'm going to contest this candidate being placed on the ballot officially in the District of Columbia, the Board of Elections, the process. So now we have to wait. We're good. We got the signatures. Now we're just waiting until the clock runs out, which is tomorrow, 5 p.m., for anybody to contest the candidate. So far, we've had nobody to challenge and to contest the candidate. So that's why tomorrow's the second milestone. The second milestone is by close of business tomorrow, if we have nobody contesting the candidate, that means he's officially on the ballot. So if he's officially on the ballot, so then here we go. It's like a process. So we don't want anybody to contest us, but we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, 5 p.m. Hopefully nobody contests him. If nobody contests him, he gets on the ballot. If he gets on the ballot, he is actually he's not just running for U.S. House of Representatives. He is the co-sponsor and writer of the bill, of the Recovery Act. So once he's on the bill, the Recovery Act is totally attached to him because he wrote him and a couple of co-sponsors. So it is his bill. So then the next thing we have to do is just promote here in the city to actually get him elected and get the citizens of the District of Columbia to come out and vote for themselves. November the 8th. Great. Oh, got to get together. But November, if we can get the citizens of the District of Columbia to come out, we will have a form of reparations. And then next week, Elliot, I know time is out, but I will go through the 10-point plan to share with the audience what reparations is going to look like under this bill. The way that we're doing this, it is at no expense to the taxpayers. We're going directly to the businesses. We're going right to the commercial businesses to pay for them. Because one of the biggest hurdles that we have, you know, reparations is like a dirty word. You know, that's why we don't call it reparations. We're calling it recovery. And the people who are paying for it is not the taxpayers. So that's the next biggest hurdle that we always have to fight. You know, you got the modern day white folks are saying, I don't have anything to do with reparations. I mean, I shouldn't have to pay for anything. I didn't enslave anybody. And they're ignorant, although they've had, I mean, we know, we're conscious. They've been a direct benefit of everything as a result of slavery, but you just can't convince them in their minds. So their whole thing is that they don't want to pay for it. So the way that we've crafted he's crafted this bill is that they don't have to. We're going after the businesses, and the businesses are going to pay for it. And then eventually, hopefully, if we use this as a business model, any bill, any law can be crafted, can be expounded upon, and we'll expound on it for other cities. But right now, we're targeting our city. For instance, in our city, in the District of Columbia, Washington Gas, we call it Washington Gas, and our water company is called DC Water. It's different in different states. In Baltimore, I think it's called BGE. But all of the water lines, all of the major infrastructure systems in the District of Columbia was laid by slaves. So BG&E from Maryland, but DC Water and Washington Gas, okay, they have benefited from slavery. All of the infrastructure that's below and beneath our feet were laid by slaves, all of that infrastructure for free. So part of the way that we've crafted this law, he's done, is that DC Water and Washington Gas have to acknowledge that, and they have to pay. They have to pay towards a recovery and repair. They have to pay for what we call recovery and repair for the work that our people have done on systems that we're still benefiting from today. And it's just that simple. And most of us in our own cities, we can look around, and I don't think this is exclusive to the District of Columbia. I think you can sit in Philadelphia and you can look at your system, and you have to, somebody has to ask the question, who built that system? Who's benefited from this? Nobody has ever questioned them about it or challenged them about it. We're doing it now. And now we're saying that you've got to pay for that. You've got to pay for that. And that's how we're separating it from the taxpayer. And to be quite honest, when we go out in subway stations and like when we're getting the signatures and when it's presented that way, we actually have a lot of Caucasian support for the bill, which people would be probably surprised about that. But they actually support it when they think they don't have to pay for it. So I don't know where this is going to go.
Well, just let us know. Come back on next week. Let us know what happened. And then we can take it from there.
Yes, but I'm very excited. Everybody, just pray for us. I'm so excited. It's ridiculous. It's the first time in the work that I've been doing that I see that we can actually have a chance to make a serious, serious difference that can affect us all nationwide. So if we can do it, oh, wow, I'm so excited. So just pray for us. But we're working here. And if we cross that line tomorrow, we're going to need you guys. We're going to need everybody to just bring the heat to D.C. and shake up our people to get them to vote and get this man on the ballot. Because this man, he's everything that we hope for in a candidate. He says he's unapologetically black. He sponsored this recovery and reparations bill. And I want him in office. In the District of Columbia, we're being gentrified, and he is totally against all of that. He is pro-black. He's pro-city, because he's got to be pro-city, but he's also pro-black, and he's not afraid to be pro-black. We got to get him on the ballot. Got to. We have our chance. Thank you.
We'll talk soon.
All right.
Peace.
Peace.
Richard, come up to an yes, end sir. Of another program. I'll be looking forward to getting more information from Mr. Moore and Mr. Collins about what's going on down there. So, you know, I'll be in touch with them, and we can take it from there. This week, the lineup is the same. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, Brother Oshie is back from his hiatus. I guess he'll be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed tomorrow. For African Perspectives with Brother Oshie from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. From 6 to 8 later on that evening, Brother Jihad Ahmed with Acres of Diamonds from 8 to 9. Let's Buy Black 365 connect with Sister Nataki and Brother Talib on Wednesday. Revive is back with Sister POC. That's from 8 to 10. On Wednesday on Time for an Awakening. Oh, I forget. How did I miss Tuesday? Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. And then on Wednesday, Revive is back with POC from 8 to 10 on Wednesday evening. On Friday, Time for Awakening is back at 8 o'clock from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. And then Saturday is SST, Saturday Sports Talk with Brother Troy Wilmore. From 10 a.m. to 12 noon. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware of, I know, the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. To do something, yeah, to save the children.